We have often spoken about the need to tell the stories of the families of the Apollo era astronauts. And today we have a special guest who is helping to do just that.
Yep, today we're joined by Dr. Tracy Scott, daughter of Apollo 15 commander Dave Scott, who's undertaken a huge research project about that very subject.
We'd love to hear from you. Please let us know your thoughts via our social media pages at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or via the contact form on our website.
And please consider joining us on patreon.com/spaceandthings. But right now, it's time for episode 187 of the Space and Things Podcast.
You're listening to the Space and Things Podcast with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.
I'm Emily Carney.
And I'm Dave Giles, and welcome to episode 187 of our podcast. How are you doing, Emily?
I'm doing good. Hanging in there. How are you doing, Dave?
Yeah, pretty good. Right. Before we get started today, we have some more sad news. George Abbey, who was one of the most influential people at NASA from 1964 until 2001, his name has come up so many times on this podcast. Unfortunately, he passed away this week. And if you follow any astronauts on social media, you're likely to have seen one of many tributes that there have been about him this week.
We're planning on doing a full episode devoted to George Abbey over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, Dave will post a link to an obituary in the show notes, and we send our deepest condolences to his friends and family.
Yeah, we really do. Feels like we have a sad announcement almost every week at the moment. So many huge names of spaceflight are leaving us now. It's very, very sad. Anyway, we're going to try and make this a bit more positive today. Let's start with this week's main feature.
Last week, we had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Tracy Scott, who is an associate teaching professor in sociology at Emory College of Arts and Sciences. Dr. Scott received an AB in economics from Stanford University, an MA in theology from Fuller Seminary, and a PhD in sociology from Princeton University. While finishing her dissertation about gender and religious differences in work values, Dr. Scott began a career as a health services researcher. She continued in that field for 11 years, first as a senior researcher at the Prudential Center for Healthcare Research, and then as a research assistant professor at Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. Although Dr. Scott valued her time in healthcare research, her primary interests are in the sociology of culture and gender and in teaching. In 2007, she moved into a full-time position with the sociology department at Emory University.
So why is any of that relevant here, you ask? Well, Dr. Scott is the daughter of Dave Scott, one of NASA's third group of astronauts who had three space missions, Gemini 8, Apollo 9, and Apollo 15. Dr. Tracy Scott has just started a brand new research project called Moonshot Astronauts, Their Families, Exploring Image versus Reality in the Early Space Era. And we really wanted to find out more. So here is our conversation with Dr. Tracy Scott.
We're cracking on. It's a celebrated event. This is Space and Things.
Tracy, welcome to Space and Things Podcast. First, we like a good scene-setting question. When did you first realize that your father, David R. Scott, was among the first U.S. astronauts? And how did you feel about that at the time? Or did you think anything about it? You know, it may have seemed commonplace.
That's an interesting question because I don't know that I even have any recollection of knowing that. How old was I when he got selected into the astronaut program? I was 2.5.
Wow.
So I don't really have any memories from when I was 2.5. And we were stationed at Edwards Air Force Base, and he was a test pilot there. And that's when he got selected into the program. And we moved to Houston when I was almost 3. So again, I don't have any conscious memory of knowing that happened. I just remember growing up and that's what he did. He was an astronaut, and all my best friends' dads were astronauts, and that's just the way it was.
So growing up among other astronauts during the Apollo program and beyond, did you feel that your father's career was really any different from others, or did you feel pretty integrated into the astronaut community in Houston as a whole among other families.
So I'm going to backtrack a little bit with this and sort of give you a little bit more of the perspective. And some of this, we can kind of think about everybody growing up, and we all grow up in a particular neighborhood and a particular place, you know, a particular family. It's what, as a sociologist, we call a social context. We all grow up in these groups, and you don't think about them. You don't think about, oh, I'm part of this group. You just are, right? You grow up in this. You don't think about the fact that it's a group that's different from any other group. It's just your family. It's just your neighborhood. So I grew up, and my neighborhood was Nassau Bay, one of the first little neighborhoods outside of the Manned Space Center. At the time, it was called the Manned Space Center. And the only people that lived in the neighborhood were astronauts and engineers that worked at NASA, a few other people, but that was just who we were. It was just my context. And I never thought about it, Emily. I never thought, oh, well, they're astronauts. And it's a really weird thing to try and explain. It was just ordinary. It was ordinary life for me. The media, it was ordinary. You know, my best friend was and a still good friend, Diane Gordon, who lived across the street from me. Her father was Dick Gordon, who was on Apollo 12. And we were in the same grade at school. And so when our fathers would fly in space, the media would be camped out on our front lawn. When her father flew in space, the media were camped out on her front lawn. They were, you know, followed us to the bus stop and took pictures. And mainly it was just annoying. It was just like, I really hate having my picture taken. And I think it's because I grew up always having my picture taken and I couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
So it was more sort of just annoying, or, you know, we would sort of not take them seriously. So it wasn't anything I'd really thought about. So some of this also with astronaut kids, it depends on how old you were, right? And It also depends on when in the program this happened. So some of what I do in my own research and with the class I teach is try to locate this historically. So astronaut isn't kind of this neutral thing that's always the same. During this time period, this was a new occupation. It had never existed before.
Yeah.
There had never been astronauts, right? The first three groups were really the core groups that kind of developed that occupation. And so it was a really unusual time and really interesting. And I don't think they knew what they were getting into. So some of this was, they were all test pilots. The first three groups, they were all test pilots or fighter pilots. They just wanted to fly. They never grew up thinking about being astronauts because there was no such thing as an astronaut.
Yeah.
They just wanted to be pilots. And then they become astronauts. And I don't think any of them had any concept of what would happen with the media and the media attention. You know, that was a really odd thing. And I think we were all kind of feeling our way through it, especially our moms, you know, the families that were behind and kind of got hounded by the media at some points. But as you get older, you begin to realize that it's not ordinary. And so as you get older and you start doing things that not everyone does, that's when you kind of realize it. So it was probably more with Apollo 15 when I was older. I was 10, I mean older. Apollo 9, I was 8. 2 years older is a little bit different. But with Apollo 15, it was also a bigger deal afterwards. And we got to go to the White House. And we had dinner at the White House. And then they flew us on the presidential helicopter to Camp David, and we spent a weekend at Camp David.
Wow.
That's what it was like. Oh, this is fun, right? This is the exciting stuff. So I think it sunk in a lot more, you know, with the later stuff.
Based on what you've just said there, as you became an adult and met new people, did it ever catch you out how people react when you tell them that your dad walked on the moon? Because for you, it was just a normal thing. That's what your dad did. But to people like me, that's a, oh, wow, your dad walked on the moon. So have you ever got used to that? And have you noticed ever that people treat you differently once they know? Is that part of it as well?
So, Dave, this is a good question. And it's actually a big question that I ask in the interviews that I'm doing with other astronaut kids. And again, I'm gonna kind of go back and say my expertise, my training, and what I teach is sociology, which is about groups and how groups shape us. And what I've discovered over time is those of us who grew up in this same neighborhood in this same time period with astronaut fathers, we have a lot of similar stories. Not always, but a lot of times the stories are really similar. And that's what I'm interested in, is the fact that we've, because of that context and what we grew up with, we were shaped in similar ways. And what I've discovered is that the kids who moved away from Houston, they confront that kind of astronaut question much, much sooner. The kids that stayed in Houston, they stay in the neighborhood. They stay around people who work at NASA. So they don't really experience questions about it until they go to college, if they go to college. But those of us who move away as kids, it's a really abrupt change. It's a really abrupt shift in your entire world. And really disconcerting, and for many of us, really horrible. I have to say, I moved away in seventh grade, that's middle school, when I was 12, and it was horrible. I had never been anywhere where anybody cared about it. So I moved to this community where the big deal is my dad's an astronaut. I'm like, oh my God, who cares about this? And middle school for girls is a terrible time. If any of you have seen the film Mean Girls, it's even worse in middle school than high school. And my middle school had really terrible mean girls. And I didn't know that at the beginning. They seemed really nice and they wanted to be my friend because they wanted to meet my dad. And when they met him and said they could, you know, had shaken the hand of a man who walked on the moon, they dropped me.
Wow. Okay.
So it was this whole celebrity fame thing that I had no inkling anyone even cared about because I had not grown up in that.
Yeah.
And so it really made me gun shy. And I went to a high school that had different people than the junior high, than the middle school. So when I went there, I said, I'm not telling anyone who my dad is.
Yeah.
By that time, he wasn't in the newspaper anymore. So I didn't tell them. And then my best friend in high school, she finds out after a year or two, and then she's mad at me that I didn't tell her. So there's this really weird thing going on, you know, and even going to college, it's not, you don't just meet people and say, hey, my dad walked on the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't do that. So it's a really odd thing and really hard to figure out if you tell people, when you tell people. I still don't tell people. And these are similar stories of the other kids that I've interviewed. And, you know, a number of us, it's our spouse that will tell people, we won't, you know. Because it's just a weird thing to say. And it's not who I am.
Yeah.
It's not who I am. It's my father, but it's not who I am. Yeah.
I've always often thought this when we've spoken to other astronaut children, it must be really tough because you don't want to be defined by the actions of your parent. No one does.
Exactly.
It's hard to escape at the same time, isn't it? Your dad walked on the moon. He's only one of 12 people to have done so. It's in a way probably annoying, more annoying for you than anyone else that more people haven't gone back, because that would have diluted some of his importance in that context, right? Which could have taken away some of that impact.
Yeah.
There's something I've always thought must weigh quite heavily on those, depending on how old they were when it happened.
Yeah. So then you get into, you know, there are these common stories, and then you get into individual differences because the families are different or they move away at different times and you deal with things differently. It was exciting. And looking back on it, you can realize how exciting it was. You can appreciate the history. It took me years to do that. It took me until probably 10 years ago before I really cared about it or did any of this. And it was more the reunions that started happening and seeing some of the kids I hadn't seen in 40 or 50 years. And realizing we had this experience that no one else had. And it was so unique at the time. And they don't have it now. I mean, you know, astronauts are not the same thing now.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a pilot. You know, there are all kinds of different astronauts. They know what they're getting into. So it was a really unique time period. And that's the kind of thing I've begun to appreciate more as I've gotten older.
Absolutely. So yeah, you've mentioned it, but your project Moonshot Astronaut Families, Exploring Image Versus Reality in Early Space Age Era, it does really sound fascinating and explores the roles and public images versus private lives of the Apollo astronauts. So one of our Patreon subscribers, James Frangioni, has asked us to put this to you, which I think is relevant here. He said, "For my money, the one story that remains untold is that of the children of Apollo, the ones who grew up during that time. The perspective is unique and fascinating. There have been some from individual astronaut children who have written their own stories, but nothing truly comprehensive. So is your work an attempt to bridge that gap? Or are you hoping that this starts a wider conversation that hopefully inspires other historians and authors and academics to perhaps help tell that story?"
That's a good question. And I will say that actually my story is more about the wives, much more about the wives. And that story has not been told.
Yeah.
The one book that is out is not in the least bit representative of most of the women. It may be representative of astronaut group one, the Mercury 7, but it is not of any of the other women. And the women I've interviewed don't like the book at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So the wives' story has not been told. I will say there's one documentary that came out that was good on the wives, and it was from the BBC, The Apollo Wives.
Yeah, James said that. He said the one he saw about the wives was very good on the BBC.
It was good, but it's a tip of the iceberg on their story. So what I've discovered, and the kids' story is important, but I don't think it's as rich or as deep as the wives.
Right.
I mean, I will touch on it a bit in my work, but I'm not going to touch on it as much as the wives, because that's the story I think that's more important, and more important that it is told. You know, unfortunately, there are not a lot of the wives still alive anymore. So I've done interviews with some of them, but I mean, my mom died 7 years ago. I wasn't able to interview her. But we have documentary evidence from them.
Yeah.
Not that NASA kept, because they didn't keep any of it. When the men divorced the wives, NASA did too.
Wow.
So they've gotten ignored and shunted away from the history. Yet that entire Apollo program would not have happened without the work of the wives. Mm. It was absolutely essential in order to allow the men to do the work they did. And we just don't care about it, right? I mean, it's just sort of, oh yeah, that's what they did. This is sort of assumption. Yeah, that's what they did, blah, blah, blah. But it's so much more than that. And it's richer and it's deeper. And there's all kinds of stuff that I really want to unpack. And I've got some really great archival data from the Life magazine reporter who covered the families.
Wow.
Dora Jane Hamlin, the reporter for Life magazine, left her papers to the University of Iowa, and she just has reams of notes and interview transcripts, and it's incredible.
Wow.
So I've got data about the wives at the time that you know, is even better than the interviews, because it's from that time period. So a lot of that is what I'm going to unpack. Again, the kids are part of the story because the wives were very involved with us. And the kids have a great window into the moms, you know, in the whole neighborhood. And it was kind of like a big extended family.
Yeah.
So that will absolutely come out. But in turn, there are lots of stories about the kids, and I'm not going to get into some of them because they're a bit, you know, it's a bit too touchy with some of this stuff. You know, I think there's some stories there in terms of family dynamics, but I don't want to get into that kind of psychodynamics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Understand. About the Apollo wives, we've seen, and you've touched on this already, we've seen a book, and we've seen some movies and TV shows that depict the astronaut wives. But as you said, you know, there are inaccuracies. So what myths might you want to diffuse here that, you know, you feel you want to diffuse about the women of Apollo?
I think it's more the characterization. So a lot of the characterization is that they're these gossipy, clubby women who just are frivolous. I don't think they're taken seriously enough. Again, it's this sort of notion, well, they're just kind of housewives in a kind of negative way. They were the parents of the kids, both the mother and the father, because the men were gone all the time. So they had to take care of the kids all the time. They had to take care of the home all the time. They had to kind of take care of the neighborhood and create community among the families. Because they also had to do actual work for NASA. So this is the part I don't think that has been brought out. They did speeches. They went around to civic groups. They went around to the contractors. They made diplomatic missions for the State Department with the husbands. So after those Apollo flights, I mean, they went to other countries and they had a State Department staff and they had an itinerary. These were official work roles. And nobody looks at that. They were actually kind of on call and working for NASA and not getting paid for any of that.
Yeah, I was about to say, did they get paid?
And they did it. Seriously. It was an enormous amount of work. Yeah. And they were oftentimes gone after Apollo 11 and Apollo 12. The wives went with the husbands on these around the world tours that were 6 weeks long. You've got young kids, you're leaving for 6 weeks, right? Mm. And oftentimes the other wives pitched in to help with the kids.
Yeah.
You had grandparents and stuff that would take care of them. But this is in the 60s. You don't usually have your mom who leaves you for 6 weeks, right? And she's the primary caretaker. So you've got this really odd role. She's actually working, but not getting paid for that work. So I don't think people have taken that seriously enough, and how much the women did and how much they sacrificed with no recognition and no credit. And again, I've got more of the documentary evidence of that. I have a wonderful speech that my mom made in 1972 that we had the reel-to-reel tape that we got digitized.
Wow.
And it's basically her telling her story about all of this stuff and all that she's done. And it's really interesting. So there's, you know, a lot of that from a lot of the women. They were amazing women.
That's incredible. I can't wait to hear more about that. Now back to the Apollo children. Have you uncovered any experiences in your research thus far that were universal to the Apollo children? Was there anything that particularly surprised you or stood out?
That's a good question too. And I should say, I'm not doing just Apollo. You know, there's so many people to interview and I've only scratched the surface because I want to do in-person interviews. So I'm having to fly around and interview people. And I'm doing one astronaut cohort. So again, as a sociologist, groups matter and the cohort matters. The people in one cohort move to the neighborhood at the same time. They live in the same neighborhood. So I'm doing group three, which was what my dad was part of. And most of the group three families lived in Nassau Bay, the same neighborhood. And some of the later Apollo astronauts were in Nassau Bay too, but they came a lot later than where we were. So I think the most common experience is this the fact that it felt ordinary for us, right? And I've seen some of the other kids who've written about stuff like that, that it just seemed really ordinary. Nobody made a big deal about us because we all lived in the same neighborhood. And the other kids had family that worked at NASA or they were around all the other astronaut kids. And so we weren't treated differently when we lived in that little bubble. We were just ordinary kids. Ordinary kids, and it was a charmed childhood. I will say that, you know, especially those kind of in my age range, I had lots of people talk about how much they loved the neighborhood and it was really this idyllic childhood and there was lots of freedom and you rode your bike everywhere. You know, it was this wonderful thing. And interestingly, there's a movie that came out last year that one of the kids told me about. It's an animated film called Apollo 10 and a Half by Richard Linklater, who's actually a big Hollywood director. And he grew up outside of that Houston area at the time. And he got people to bring home footage of our neighborhoods from that time period to help him create this film. And it's a fictional film about a kid that wants to go to the moon, but it's about one of the neighborhoods, El Lago, which was the other main one. And the other astronaut kid that watched this said, oh my God, you have to watch this. This was our childhood. It's so much our childhood. And it is. It really captures the spirit of it in a way that I think those of us who lived there at the time felt that way. Yeah. So it was a charmed life as a kid.
I have a question which might be a tad personal. So if you don't want to answer it, I won't be offended. But you mentioned earlier that the wives brought up the children because the dads were never around. So does that mean that you or perhaps other astronaut children didn't have a very close relationship with your fathers? And did that come for you? Did that come later on? Did you almost get to know your dad later in life? Is that a similar experience that perhaps others have had? Or again, if you don't want to answer, you don't have to. But I'm interested by that.
I can answer that. It varied. So, I mean, the kind of pattern was the men would leave Sunday night and come back Friday night.
Right.
So they would fly out Sunday night to go wherever it was they were going to be training, and they'd come back Friday night. And this is all in the documentation. And a lot of this is in the notes of the Life journalist talks about this a lot. So the men would be home from Friday night to Sunday night, and some of them spent more time with the kids than others. In fact, you know, Dora Jane Hamblin's got notes about this, about which of the guys spent more time with the kids and which didn't, and kind of what they did. So it did vary by family. My dad actually spent a lot of time with us, and he spent a lot of time explaining things to us. So my dad was a bit different in terms of he liked explaining the science. You know, I heard the podcast with David Woods, and my dad, I think, would have been a great professor because he loves explaining complex things in a way that people can understand. And he would do that with us. He actually did it with my mom a lot and some of the other wives. So in the Life magazine reporter's book that they wrote about Apollo 11, they have a section in there about how my dad spent time with Jan Armstrong during Apollo 11 explaining the mission to her.
Wow.
So, and they knew each other because of Gemini 8.
Yeah.
And my dad had flown with Neil, and my mom and Jan Armstrong were quite close. So he kind of played that role a lot and explained things. And I've always been close to him. But, you know, some of that gets into the individual family dynamics, which is why it gets complicated. And I kind of don't go into that with a lot of the other kids. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that being a minefield. And also there's a certain amount we shouldn't know. Like Emily and I have discussed this before when we've discussed it. Like for us, it's fascinating. And we want to learn more about the dynamics especially the role of the wives. We've spoken about this a lot. We really do want to know more about their role, because as you said, there's a lot we don't know, and they're important. Yeah. They're important characters in this history that we should know about. But at the same time, there's plenty of stuff that should be off limits. You know, you guys are entitled to privacy. And,
privacy.
And that often gets forgotten about, in my opinion. So I'm always nervous about asking certain questions about that. So is the plan... I never know with academic studies. Is the plan to write a book that will be released, or is it to publish in a journal, or how? What's your intention with this incredible research that you're doing right now?
I do want to write a book. So I do think there's enough for a book, and I've talked with one of my former graduate school advisors about that. And it's a long way off.
Yeah.
I would say it's a long way off. This is a long project. So I do want it to be a book, and I've kind of sketched out a lot of pieces of that. In the meantime, what I'm really trying to do is make some of the primary source data available to people.
Right.
So some of the issue here is we have reams of material about the men and the missions, right? There's amazing stuff, the Apollo Flight Journal and all of these videos that different people have made available, but there's almost no data about the wives or the families or the communities. So some of this is wanting to make that data available along with the interviews. A lot of the interviews I'm doing, the people are allowing me to make them public. They are oral history interviews. So I've got a website under development now, which hopefully will be up in the fall. And we're putting the oral history interviews there.
Wow.
So we've got, you know, we're doing mock-up pages now, and I've got to go back to the people and say, you know, what do you want public, what not, and all that kind of stuff. And we will also put some documents there. I donated my mom's papers to Emory, and my father's donating his papers to Emory as well. Emory's where I teach. So we have some really fascinating documents. My parents were pack rats, and they kept everything. And I mean everything, which now is good because I've got a lot of documentary evidence, especially from my mom, that we just don't have in a lot of other places. So we have her itinerary and all the State Department stuff from their trip to Poland and Yugoslavia after Apollo 15. So there's some really interesting things, and I'm going to try to digitize some of those documents and put them online as well so people can get a feel for things. We'll put her speech online so people could hear it or look at the transcript. And this is one of the wives talking about her experiences in 72. So it's from that time. Yeah. So some of it is just wanting to sort of develop an archive and make it available, because NASA did not keep that stuff.
I think it's fantastic work. I mean, the website that's up at the moment has already got so much cool stuff on it, and the images and some of your talks that I've watched as well that really are very insightful. So I'm really pleased that someone is doing this. And not just that someone is doing it, someone who was on the inside is doing it. I think that adds an extra dynamic to this, which I think helps it. Are you concerned with anything you write that people might feel like you're not detached enough from it to give a perspective? Do you have to factor that in when you're writing, or when you're researching and asking questions of fellow astronaut children or families?
Yes, absolutely. And part of this, so what's so kind of odd about all of this is that I kind of left this part of my life behind during college. My college essay that I wrote to get into college, the prompt was, what would you write a book about if you were going to write a book? And my answer was, I would write a book about all the misconceptions of what it's like to be an astronaut. I left that behind, and now I've come back to it.
Yeah.
Funny enough. And I had to really move away from it in order to kind of have my own life.
Yeah.
Right. So I did all sorts of different things. I eventually went to graduate school and got the PhD in sociology, which is the perfect kind of thing to do for this project.
Yeah.
So I'm trained as a researcher who looks at groups and tries to understand them from the inside, what we call a qualitative researcher, not someone that does the numbers as much, but that would like live with a group of people and get to know them and interview them and try and understand the whole group.
Right.
So what I'm doing with this is approaching it the same way as a researcher. I was part of the group, right?
Yeah.
I did grow up with them, but I can bracket that out. I've been away from it enough. I know when it's just me and when it's more of a group story.
Yeah.
So my whole thing is, this is a group. I'm going to tell the group story, the common patterns, and I'm not going to try to tell an individual story. People have their own memoirs, and that's great. This is more one where I'm trying to illuminate the common experiences we had. And I think I can do that in a way no one else can, because I was part of it, Dave. And even in the interviews, they're not typical oral history interviews, because I knew these people.
Yeah.
So it's more like a conversation, but I also know questions to ask them that no one else would know how to ask.
Yeah.
So it is an odd kind of thing, but I will be kind of involved in it. And I'll just be upfront about that, right?
Yeah.
I'm not like a complete outsider, but I can also get at things that an outsider couldn't get at. So it will be kind of a funny mix, but I'm hoping it'll be an interesting mix.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can't wait to see how it develops. And I'm sure Emily's the same. Thank you very much for spending some time with us this afternoon. This has been absolutely fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. And we wish you all the best with your research, and can't wait to see the results and some of this archive material. I really can't wait to see it. I think it's fantastic.
This is exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You guys are great. And
thank you.
I appreciate the interest. I really do. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Please leave a review on your podcast platform. We love hearing your thoughts.
That was incredible. I really can't wait for this to come out.
This is amazing, isn't it?
I did not know any of that stuff existed with the wives being interviewed and stuff, but it's time that this stuff gets talked about. It really is. I mean, those women did so much. We just don't remember them as much as we should. You know, we talk about the astronauts, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think it was Barbara Cernan who said once in an interview, if you think it's hard going to space, try staying at home.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. It was Barbara Cernan I've seen say that as well. This is a really cool project for many reasons. And perhaps there'll be people who listen to that interview went, why did you not ask that? There are so many questions we could have asked that are probably a bit too personal to ask, but also there's,
exactly.
There's so many ways we could have taken this, but we only have so much time with people. So there's so many cool things about this. Even as it was going on, I'm like, oh my God, we could find out about this. And the good thing is we're going to find out what we need to know. And that's all that matters. The stuff we
that's
need
all
to know is going to come out in these archives that's going to be presented to us. And any complex family dynamic that should be out of bounds for us will be out of bounds for us. And I trust that Tracy will do that correctly, because these are people she knows. Why would she want to do it any differently?
Why would she put all their stuff out there, you know?
And I think that's absolutely perfect for this kind of project, that someone who knows these people, who grew up with that experience, who knows what it's like to have invasive media in your life, is the one who's actually trying to be the one who's putting in the definitive resource of, here's what it was like to be the wife of an astronaut in 1960s, and here's what it was like to be a kid, a child to in that dynamic as well. I also love the fact, and I'd love your perspective on this, I love the fact that she's focusing primarily on the groups. So particularly group three, I think on the website it says there might be some group two stuff as well coming up as well. But I think what that does, and this is really interesting, is how many were in group three? Was it 10?
Oh gosh.
No, that can't be right. Let me quickly do this. It was Aldrin, Anders, Bean, Bassett, Cernan, Collins, Chaffee, Cunningham, Isley, Freeman, Gordon. I think I'm doing this in alphabetical order. Check that out. Schweikart, Scott, and Williams, of course. So 14. I just counted on my fingers. Yes. But of those, four of them died. Bassett.
Yeah.
Chaffee, Freeman, and Williams, I think sometimes we hear from Chaffee about Chaffee's family, and certainly I've seen interviews with Roger Chaffee's wife appear in some documentaries, but very rarely do we hear from the other families.
Yeah.
And what were their experiences of how that panned out? Because that's a very different experience to the glory of my dad walked on the moon or my husband walked on the moon. And that's going to come out because she's focusing on the group, not on the Apollo group, so to speak.
Yep.
I think that's fascinating, don't you?
Yeah, I do think that's fascinating. And I think I want to hear about their experiences, because I'm sure their experiences are probably extremely different from those of Tracy or other children whose dads actually flew to the moon. I don't think NASA back then was as emotionally sensitive as it probably is now.
Yeah.
I don't want to tear into NASA, but I think back then their way of dealing with stuff like that was kind of like, okay, we're just going to kind of dump these people and put them aside. Not the right way to deal with it, but it was the 60s. That's how a lot of things were dealt with back then. You know, people didn't want to talk about death back then. I don't think NASA is like that now. I'm sure there's been a lot of changes there, but I'm sure that experience was doubly traumatic, because not only did you lose a parent in probably a terrible accident, right, which is awful, you also lost your community of people. Now you might have to move.
Yeah,
that's not fun. Nobody talks about that, and how insanely difficult that must have been on many levels during that decade.
Yeah, there's so many facets to this, isn't there? And you know, we just had 30 minutes with Dr. Scott. Such a huge subject, and that's why it's going to take her years to do it. I think she's already been spending over a year on this research, and it's going to take a lot longer because there's going to be so much stuff to go through and so many stories that need to come out, and then you have to sensitively put them all together. And I think it's a fascinating project, and I can't wait to see what comes of it.
Me too.
If you and I have been screaming for something like this, haven't we? You know, it feels like we've been having this conversation of it needs more needs to be done. More needs to be done to tell these stories. And finally, it feels like it's being done, but being done by the right person.
Exactly. Being done by somebody who was inside that bubble, who was there, you know, and who has, I think, a sensitive perspective about it. Like, she knows what to look for.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what comes from it. I can't wait to see the data from it. I think Dr. Scott is the right person to do this. Absolutely. And I just can't wait to see what comes from it.
Yeah. So, of course, I will put a link to Dr. Scott's website on our show notes. It's tracylscott.org is where you need to go. But in case you can't remember that, just go and click on what it says in the show notes, which you can find in the description of this episode in your podcast provider, or head to our website, spaceandthingspodcast.com. But definitely already it's worthwhile watching. And we know, as we've just heard, there's a lot more information coming. So check that out. And if you want to watch the full interview, then head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings.
Where things meet space. This is Space and Things.
So, Emily, what has caught your eye in spaceflight this week?
Well, what caught my eye this week, it's an article from scientificamerican.com, and I sent Dave the link, so it should be in the show notes for reading. But due to budget cuts, one of the great observatories may be facing its end, according to this article. The Chandra X-ray telescope, which obviously, according to its name, images in the X-ray spectrum, its budget has been slashed, and many astronomers who work in X-ray astronomy are obviously unhappy. So they have banded together to launch a Save Chandra campaign to prolong the telescope's life. According to this article, the justification to end the telescope is basically the telescope is old. It was launched in 1999, I think, on STS-93, which was the first mission commanded by a woman. I remember because I think I watched the launch when it was going up back then. So anyway, the justification for ending its mission is basically it's old. And Patrick Slane, who is the director of the Chandra X-ray Center in Massachusetts, has said, are there issues with the spacecraft? Yes. Do they necessitate this action? No. And according to Fred Jansen, who is the former project scientist for the Europe's XXM Newton X-ray telescope, he was basically saying, you know, the size of the X-ray astronomy community has grown a lot. There are young astronomers who are getting into this field who need exposure to this kind of stuff, basically. So people are trying to fight it. Of course, a few weeks ago, you may remember we talked to Casey Dreyer, mm-hmm. who is a space policy expert with the Planetary Society. We did two really amazing episodes with him. And here's another example of how budgets are being slashed, and it's affecting programs that have been going for the last 25 odd years or so. Yeah, it'll be 25 years that this telescope has been up. For perspective, Hubble is 9 years older than Chandra. It was launched in 1990, and Hubble also has issues as well. It's 34 years old. That's a pretty long time in space, but the difference is Hubble has gone through some upgrades. I don't think Chandra has undergone any maintenance or anything of that type. But still, it continues to work in the X-ray spectrum, and it continues to return pretty awesome data. And personally, I see both sides of the story. You know, I understand that it is old, but, you know, there is also that side of me that's like, well, what about young astronomers who need that exposure in that particular area? You know, yeah. So I don't know. I kind of see both sides of the equation.
One of those things, it's almost a PR thing, isn't it? You have to present the case to keep it going.
Yeah.
These things are expensive, and if it has a value, we need to hear about it, and we need to make that accessible and easy to understand for the general public, so that people can say, yeah, this is worth keeping. Obviously, we want everything to be kept going, but there's only so many people out there to work on these projects, and arguably newer stuff takes preference, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when you put something else up there, which perhaps has got slightly better technology, yes, you can still use the old thing, but how much time and effort and money have you got to be able to do it? And that's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah. And another thing that that is in the article that I didn't really bring up is that Chandra actually is helping to augment some of the JWST images.
Okay. Yeah,
that's another thing. And because Chandra still is very high res in the X-ray, I guess, spectrum, you would call it. So it's really good at its job still, you know, even though it was launched in the 90s, it's still very good at what it does. So it helps to augment the JWST findings, which, you know, if Chandra went away or was retired, they wouldn't have that anymore.
Yeah.
So that's another issue, is that a lot of these space observatories that are even the older ones, they do serve a significant purpose. It's not like they're just, you know, chilling out or something like that, or they're just being operated for fun. You know, they do serve significant scientific purposes in either their own field or augmenting other programs that are capable of discovering incredible things. As we know, JWST is really changing the game as far as astronomy is concerned, and it has, you know, the capability for it and observing is probably unlimited. So, yeah.
It's one of those things. The more these things happen, the more I'm glad we spoke to Casey and got an understanding of how this all works as well. So if you haven't listened to that interview yet, please go and check that out.
Yeah.
It was over two parts, but every single part of it was fascinating.
So, Dave, what caught your eye this week?
Well, to me, it's the fact that potentially Boeing Starliner is going to launch with two astronauts on it, maybe in May, maybe as early as May. Now, this has been delayed for a long time, but I think this might go horrifically under the radar because now we have the Dragons going up so regularly and doing so well. This was supposed to be ready alongside that. And yes, it's a few years late. But you think about the hype that we got when Bob and Doug launched and how exciting that was because it was the first crewed flight from Kennedy Space Center for a number of years. And all that kind of stuff. It was really cool. This was supposed to go alongside here. And the crew, Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, both veteran astronauts, aren't going to get the adulation and the respect that perhaps, I'm sure they will within the industry, but not necessarily from the general public as they deserve. They're about to get inside a spacecraft and launched for the first time. They're going to be the first people to do it in this spacecraft.
Yeah.
There's very few people who have done that across time. There are very few people, and that's a big thing. And let's be fair here. The issues that Boeing have had recently.
I was about to bring that up, unfortunately.
You know, it's not like they're coming into this smelling of roses right now, which arguably you could say SpaceX were when Bob and Doug went up. You know, they hadn't had any issues for a number of time. They'd proven themselves. Boeing aren't the most sound of companies at the moment. So I would say this is a bigger risk. Yeah, there's a lot of scrutiny on this.
I'm worried that they're not going to get really the attention they deserve for what they're doing. And also, I'm worried that the scrutiny is going to fall less on them going to space and more on Boeing.
It's going to be launched on top of an Atlas V, the United Launch Alliance Atlas V, which I think, in my mind, takes a lot of the pressure off Boeing in many ways, because I think we think a lot of the launch drama often, we think about the rocket itself.
Yeah.
But obviously, they've still got to get home. It's still got to be operational. So perhaps the launch itself, I'm less worried about than other aspects of the flight. But I really hope that these two that Butch and Sonny, I hope they get a lot of recognition for the fact that, that they're about to enter the history books as the first people to fly on a spacecraft, which, as I said, it hasn't happened often. There aren't many people who can say that. John Young did it twice.
Exactly. Isn't that crazy?
Isn't that crazy? Yeah,
that is crazy. Not many people can say that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if it goes on time, we hope, obviously, we want it to go as well as possible. And hopefully it's a chance for Boeing to turn their fortunes around a little bit, because they're historically a very important part of aerospace. And we want them operating in as well as possible. So hopefully it will all be great. And it'll be great to have another spacecraft functional and operational, because that opens more doors to all
exactly.
of us.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree. I'd like to see the Dragons and the Starliners, and I'd like to see all these spacecrafts survive well beyond the ISS period. You know, just for, you know, whatever spaceflight purposes. I think that would be cool. I don't think any of that should be relegated to one program only, hopefully. I'm hoping to see those go past the ISS era, possibly to be used for other things. That would be really cool. Or for other space stations? I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm hoping this is a big success and it's not overshadowed by other unpleasant things that are in the news right now.
Absolutely. So, yeah, hopefully we're going to have a successful launch of a brand new spacecraft with Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams. And we're going to be talking about that all year if it goes well and if it goes ahead. I hope so anyway.
Are you dreaming of a holiday to the ISS? Well, you've come to the right place. This is Space and Things.
Okay, that's it for this week. Next week, we're talking about the eclipse, which is taking place on April the 8th. And we've already got a really great interview recorded for it. So how about that for good preparation? Thanks to all those who have signed up to our Patreon page recently. We're getting very close to our target of 100 Patreons by show 200. When we finish recording today's episode, we're going to do our monthly prize draw for our subscribers. So check out this week's video to see if you've won within the Patreon group. And if you want to be part of it, head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings.
A huge thank you to all who support what we do. We really do appreciate it. But don't forget, in space, no one can hear you meep.
Thanks for listening to the Space and Things podcast. Back next week with a whole lot more.